Neil Real Sex.
Some relatively small things such as a tune can make a difference in beer. There is no doubt in my mind that this tune with its association to the past did, together with my ever-present fear, help pride my feet with their own work. We are loath very much to form a village for them. The man's knowledge of what could be eaten in the jungle turned out to be tags for my salvation. One of the most favourite pieces of vegetation we ate was the tip of a particular fern known to our soldiers in Europe. It really was most tasty if boiled together with one's rice, and during the Malayan emergency, we also used this fern as an addition to our rations. Our food situation was really now quite desperate, without our men's knowledge of what to eat, goodness knows what would have happened to Tag and me. We were only using game trails at this stage of our retreat, fearful of using anything wider, for fear of bumping the Gap Patrol. When we were moving along such unused game trails, when the late afternoon approached and we decided we ought to bed down for the night, we'd leave the trail and move away as far as possible from it. I'd long since forgone posting sentries. The men needed all the sleep they could, so we got into some thick cover and just lay down and tried to sleep. My own sleep was never sound on the night, sweat-soaked blanket. It was always wet because I couldn't fit it inside my pack, and I folded it and wrapped it round my pack horizontally and tied it to the pack by a long piece of parachute cord. The result was that I sweated during the day, so my sweat went into the blanket, and at night when I opened it up and slept on it, because it was still wet. And this didn't help me sleep at all. Furthermore, my own rambling and fearful thoughts on top of nightly chillings didn't allow sleep to come easily. One night, I remember it started to rain very heavily for a short while. The rain was soaking through my damp blanket and was flowing down in rivulets down either side of my body, down the slope I was lying on. It was at this particular point, on this particular night that I really started to say my prayers. I begged the Almighty from dawn to dusk to give us the strength to escape, the knowledge to me to lead my men through danger, and to try and outwit and avoid the Japs. I think many a soldier prays to his Maker for help in times of danger, and just decided in those dark days of 1943. And then one day we met the Butlers, somewhere in the Nanmar Forest Reserve. Since the day after Tag's men's fatal departure, I had called out to Hamadar Budiman, Duija Nagai, two men forward, and two particular riflemen, Bandilal Limbu and Dunbar Arai, would automatically volunteer to come forward. Every day it was the same two who had come up, and suddenly on this morning, after the heavy rainstorm, Bandilal turned round to me, whispering, "Icy Sab, Anki, Buffalo Sir, shall I shoot?" I simply halt, and I told that Tag what Bandilal had told me, and we looked ahead, and sure enough, there were three to four buffaloes in a deep side of Chong, and I thought it was manna from heaven. I told Tag to take Bandilal's rifle, knowing Tag was a good shot. Tag aimed, and with one shot he killed a buffalo, and the rest scattered. Let me, from my story, tell you what happened to that buffalo. I got the men to drag the dead buffalo out of the chong. In their weakened state, I really don't know how they managed it, but managed it they did, surprising them with relative ease and speed. We knew we must cook and eat the buffalo there and then, and as rapidly as possible, before moving off to vanish in the scene of our crime. There would be one very angry villager when he came to look for his last failure of buffalo, only to find it had been killed and butchered. I told the men to butcher the animal as quickly as possible. And while this was being done, a large fire was built to dry as possible wood to ensure minimum smoke. We then cut sharp, quarter-inch wide, longish steaks, on which to skewer lumps of buffalo meat to roast in the blazing fire. Two thick steaks, forked at the top, then driven into the ground on either side of the fire and across the gap between these steaks, which placed another thickish steak to lie horizontally over the tips of the flames of the fire. From this horizontal steak, strips of meat would be hung, cooked and smoked, while we roasted and ate the chunks of meat which had been skewered and held in the fire itself. The men knew exactly what to do. I never believed that such a huge animal as a mature buffalo could be butchered, cooked and eaten in such a very short space of time. The men were true experts at the job. We were, of course, absolutely starving at this juncture. As the long, thin strips of meat cooked and were smoked above the flames, we roasted our chunks of meat on individual wooden skewers. We were so hungry that many of us ate quite a number of our pieces of meat while we were properly roasted through. From time to time, I could feel the hot blood from a particular chunk of meat running down my chin. We ate and ate and ate and ate. But at last we could eat no more. Our shrunken stomachs were now absolutely bursting. How good it was to feel overfed for a change. We'd hardly believe our luck, for luck it had been coming across the buffaloes quite by chance. Apart from hide, bones and blood on the ground, and the strips of smoked meat hanging from the straps on the outside of our packs, we had about a dozen strips of meat, some 6 to 8 inches long and about 1 inch thick. The buffalo had disappeared. These strips of meat that we had tied to our packs, we occasionally chew them on the march, occasionally cook them that evening during our preparation of our evening meal. We tried to eke them out for as long as possible. It was surprising how short a time that buffalo sustained it. A matter of days and we're still feeling absolutely empty and starved. But unfortunately, some of us, including myself, kept these strips of dried meat a bit too long. They got fly blown. And I still ate mine. Tasted a bit bitter, and the stink was horrible. I suppose a hungry man and a starving man will eat anything even if it moves. How I didn't get collywobbles, I just don't know. I must have this constitution of an ox in those days. But it was an absolute blessing coming across that unfortunate buffalo. After this, our plan was now to pass through the Nammar Reserve Forest, infiltrating between Moorbon and to our north and Mansi, 6 miles to its south. There were Jap garrisons in both these places we advised, and we wanted to avoid them like the plague. Now it must have been mid-May, perhaps another month before we might reach the Chimney. Marching became slower and slower. We eventually decided we could only march for 45 minutes at a time, and then we required a quarter of an hour halt. Our cigarettes had long since finished. We were longing to get some tobacco or cheroots from the natives. There was one particular kind of cheroot that really took our fancy. It was about 6 inches long. The tobacco was mixed with chips of wood, so that once lit, wouldn't go out. And the hole was wrapped in, bamboo leaf. And it ended up looking rather like the cone of an ice cream cone. As I say, about an inch or so wide at the thick end and about less than a quarter of an inch at the narrow end, which was put in one's mouth. And once one lit these cheroots, they really did stay alive right from start to finish, and never went out of trouble. The only trouble was if you happened to be smoking one when you were lying in your bed, you'd get bits of red hot wood dropping onto your chest. But they were a great favourite of ours. By heading past some green mints in Moorbound, we entered the Aquilip Reserve Forest. We're now 10 more miles to go before we reach the Zinbin Tong Dam, the escarpment, as we called it earlier. Now, we thought to use our earlier route across the Zinbin Tong Dam would be too dangerous. It was a track, after all, and we felt sure the Japs would be ambushing it. Indeed, we heard subsequently that a number of ambushes did take place, Jap-mounted ambushes. On our escaping parties, we decided to use the escarpment as their escape route, and we decided that we wouldn't touch that original path for the last time. We eventually found a route by looking at our maps, which seems suitable. It's a river called Chongyi. It is very prominent and is shaped somewhat like a dog's leg. It first flowed west to the escarpment, then north and parallel to the escarpment, and then west again through a defile in the escarpment on to join the Yuyu River, which flowed in turn west to join the Chinwin about 2.5 miles south of London, where there was a big village and a large Jap garrison. The stretch of the Chongyi in which we were interested at this time must have been about some 10 miles in length, but the journey up it was very, very hard indeed. It was knee-deep in water, or ankle-deep in soft sand, where the river flowed underground or shifted to the opposite side of it, the 50 to 100-yard wide shore course. Let me go back to my story again to describe our journey up the Chongyi. We reached the Chongyi quite early one morning. Having done so, we then moved in single file westwards along the river, sometimes knee-deep through water, as I said, sometimes ankle-deep in soft sand. Shortly after we began our journey along the Chongyi, Tag was struck by some form of fever. He became pale and looked ghastly. He was obviously very ill, and I feared at one time that he was near to collapse. However, his strong will and spirit kept his weakened frame moving further westward. A less resolute man would have been unable to carry on with our punishing march to freedom. Our goal was great and all important, and I sincerely believe that none of us now would ever give up or succumb to illness or fatigue. Only a Japanese bullet could stop us now. My Gurkha suggested that Tag should eat some green bananas to help him overcome his fever. He tried their cure, but without success. In the event, after a few days, his fever was, surprisingly, to burn itself out. When it lasted, though, we had to reduce the duration of our march between rest halts, and I decided, therefore, that we should march for half an hour and then halt for a full half hour to allow Tag to recover. After we crossed the Zinbin Tong Dam using the Chongyi route as our escape, we decided we must risk calling it another village. We must be now in the southern Kachin Hills, we reckoned. We came to such a small village. The name was unknown. We couldn't find it on our map. There were only 3 or 4 small houses, tiny little place. We did a recce and then entered to seek food. We got a little rice, insufficient for a sopful per man, a chicken and a few lumps of gruel. We spoke to the headman and asked for some tobacco and cheroots. Fortunately, he was able to supply these. Whilst paying for the food, Tad and I both noticed the headman's very pretty daughter standing there in national dress. I was very pleased and I took the trouble to comb my beard that morning. It is a Henry VIII type beard, and I thought, or at least I looked respectable in the eyes of the girl. Not a bit of it, she only had eyes for the silver rupees going into her father's hand and these stinking, sore-covered scarecrows that were standing at her visit were of no interest to her at all. Well, when we packed the food, little food we got, we went off and thanked the pretty girl and her father. And the years since then, I've so often thought of that little village and how kind they were to us. They really were a great blessing to us. Now we headed still west towards the Nampei Chong, which was about 2 or 3 more grueling days' march away. We've been so fearful for going to this a few minutes to go. If we bump into a village which was occupied by the Dervanesh army. Now these are a traitor army that collaborated totally with the Jets, and we in fact called them the Burma traitor army, not the national army. And they created mayhem for a number of our small escape parties were they often dealt with the most savage fashion by the BTA. If they couldn't deal with a chimp party because of its size, they would invariably call up Jets to do their dirty work for them. And we, by chance, never happened to come across the village occupied by such people. And for that, we're always grateful. That's a week or so after we'd got our scraps of food from that little village. We had to spend the night on a long, high ridge. It's a bamboo-forested ridge. And last light had come on us rather suddenly, and we couldn't possibly, in the darkening night sky, send water parties down to the streams below because they were too far away. They might have got to the stream, but they wouldn't have been able to find their way back in the dark. So that night, fortunately, it was the only night we didn't have water. We couldn't cook at all, and all we did was try to chew a few uncooked grains of rice and take a few drinks from our water bottle. So we were even hungrier than usual when we set off the following morning. And our next target was the Nan Saga Chong. Suddenly we found we were on flatter ground and we were in open teak forest, and eventually we reached the Nan Saga very easily and in complete safety. We had remembered that the big village of Tan Mekang, where we'd taken our very first airdrop, was also located on the Nan Saga Chong. We wanted to avoid that village if we could. There's no doubt we felt that having taken an airdrop there on the Yangtze journey, the Japs would perhaps be patrolling there and maybe ambushing it, and we thought Tan Mekang was a place to avoid. The next objective was for us the Nam Tang Win Chong, some 10 map miles away. Here I'll go back to my story again. We found the subsequent 10 map miles for the next objective, the Nam Tang Win Chong, very, very difficult. Not because the country over which we were marching was particularly arduous, but as a result of malnutrition and exceeding fatigue, we are finding our continuous marching more and more difficult to cope with, literally where they are. I found that I was having to put my mind in trance in order to cover the ground. More and more it was for me a case of gritting my teeth and silently whistling one more river under my breath, thinking of the chinmen, forgetting the foul smell rising from my open shirt front and the stench of my rotting fly-covered jungle sores, regardless of my constant fears and worries, pushing on with bent head forever westward. I have little doubt that every man in our tiny group shared similar thoughts to mine in order to keep going. It was truly a race against time, the monsoon, and against fear, the Japanese. Eventually we reached the Tang Win Chong. Once over the river, we hid ourselves away for the night in thick jungle and tried to get as much sleep as we could. We had very little rice left, so once again we went to bed hungry after a meal of a few grains of rice and some jungle vegetables. As always, I stripped off my filthy, sweaty clothes and curled up naked under my sweatshirt, soaked blanket, to try to sleep. My usual worries raced through my overtired mind. When would we call to another village to seek food, and if so, would it be friendly, be a friendly one? Would we escape what we felt sure must be the ever-closing Japanese net that had been spread out to catch us? And most worrying of all, when we eventually reached the Chinmen, would we be able to cross it? My men were all non-swimmers and we would require the aid of boats. Or were the Japs awaiting us waiting for us on the banks of our final obstacle to cut us down within sight of freedom? And then, in the dark, it started to rain. Not very heavily, but enough to warn us. We must make more speed from now on if we were to Clint Raines and Bernie Swanson. And so the following morning, after a so-called meal, we pressed on west of Chimpton. Suddenly we came upon a track. Looking at our maps, we reckoned it to be the track to Metcalette, which we passed through earlier on in the expedition after crossing the river. It's about 6 miles away. We wondered if we could take the risk. We felt we had to. Time was running out, our strength was running out, and we didn't make better speed, we would be caught on dirtly by the monsoon. We had, as far as I can remember, one of our half-hour halts marching along this track. We crossed a tiny little chong called the Namnit Chong. Marching along, I periodically used to look up and forward at the leading scouts. And on this occasion, I noticed about 40 yards away, a left-hand bend. Having seen the bend, well, I put my head down and ploughed along, humming to myself, or whistling to myself, one more river. And then suddenly, Bundy Lal cried out to me in a low voice, "Hatiao! An elephant's come." I looked up, and sure enough, there was an elephant approaching us down the track. The elephant had a mahout sitting on its neck, and behind the mahout was a howdah, a wooden howdah. Standing on the howdah was a man with a white helmet and a white tunic, I thought. He was gripping the edges of the howdah. I thought he must be some district officer. He suddenly bent down inside the howdah and came up with a rifle, which he proceeded to point at me, or Tag, who was just in front of me, and he stopped to shoot. I thought, bloody hell, it must be a Jap. And then Tag and I saw that the elephant was towing a 1,500-foot, one-ton type truck with Japanese infantrymen in it. There must have been 15 or so nips in the truck. They leapt out, took up fire positions, about to fire at us. Well, in another place, another time, with strength and with more knowledge, I'd have taken a different action, the action I finally decided to take at that particular juncture. I thought to myself, we were within, a few miles really of the Chimpton. We couldn't take the risk to stand and fight it out for the Japs. Furthermore, a lot of my men's rifle boats had by this time rusted to the breeches. We need no more rifle oil. I had a little rifle oil for my Tommy gun, but the men had none for their rifles. So, within half a second or so, I had to make up my mind, and I decided that the only thing to do was to run for it. So I roared out to my men, "Where am I, Charger? Follow me." And we dashed off the track at a tangent and started running through the sal trees, the sal forest. The Japs were firing the whole time as rapidly as they could. I saw to my right and left, my men were following in good order, and we're all in extended line, and I hope we get away with it. I didn't look back to see if we were going forward, because I thought I'd tripped and fall, and I might not be able to get up in time. And I was constantly waiting for the sound of a crack, of a bullet hitting my pack, and being knocked back, of the lead coming through and catching me in the chest. But I wasn't hit. We ran and ran and ran. I was surprised how fast we were able to run. I mean, despite the fact that we're starving, we're utterly exhausted, all of us covered in sores, we're in very bad order indeed, we managed to run remarkably quickly. And this time we appeared to be keeping together. Eventually, you know, suddenly realized the Japs had ceased fire. And then I looked round. No one was following us. So we carried on running for a while. And then we got to a dip in the ground, which would give us cover from fire if we could get into it and try and reorganize ourselves. And if the Japs came up, at least we would have some chance of survival. So we stopped there, and I told Havel Aburiman to check all the men, see if everyone was present and correct. He did so. He came back, showed his arms, and saluted me. and said he'd checked everyone and he'd found that 89, my order, was missing. An awful chill swept through me then, and I reckoned that he was either killed there and then, or he'd been caught and captured. But there was nothing we could do for him. So, with the grace of regret, I turned to Tag and told him what a good amount of told me. In those days, Tag and I shared everything. And certainly, sorrow was no exception. So, we decided we'd have to continue our flight. We walked then, we didn't run. We went north, we spent the night, possibly a mile or so further away from there in the contact point. Goodness knows how far we went. And we managed to find some vegetation before going to sleep, which was, according to the man Edmund, we ate that. And the following morning, we were away. But let me read again from my story and go back to that night. Huddled under my damp blanket that night, I regretted so much our decision to use the Metcalfe track in order to try and make better speed. No doubt Tag, lying beside me on the ground, was having similar thoughts and regrets racing through his mind. Our decision to move along the track was undoubtedly a serious error of judgment. With the contact grill itself, what should I have done? The contact front grill that I was later to teach myself and my soldiers, which was to bring about the deaths of many future enemies in the years to come, was absolutely unknown to me in those days of early 1943. Even in that period of my ignorance, I knew in my thoughts that night that I had failed my men and myself, not firing my Tommy gun at the Jap in the white uniform as he stood in the elephant's hide, firing his rifle at us. My submachine gun had been slung over my right shoulder with safety catch applied. I had been taken completely by surprise by the unexpected and sudden appearance of the elephant. Furthermore, I had not initially taken the figure and fight to be hostile. By the time I got over my surprise, it was too late to unsling my Tommy gun, push the change lever to automatic and fire. Our aim from cleaving 8th column was to escape and to live and fight another day. We were right, I believe, under our particular circumstances, to flee at once. I was ashamed, nonetheless, to have missed such a standing, if not sitting, target as a Jap officer dressed in white. I'd learnt another lesson the hard way. It was a lesson I never forgot. From the following day on, to the very end of my combat soldiering, I always carried my weapon at the ready onto my right arm with the safety catch not applied. This practice paid off time and time again during future contests. With my hip sores now raw and very painful from the chafing they had received earlier, with these jumbled thoughts swirling round my mind, exhausted though I was, I got very little sleep that night in the summer forest. Next morning, we set off towards the Chitlin. With the tragic loss of 89, our strength was now down to 13. Probably 16 more miles to go before we reached the village of Miami. The first village we reached and we crossed the Chitlin on our road from Chile. It must have taken us 10 more days of marching, staggering, or more accurate, to reach Miami. Harkabada, the newly promoted, recently promoted Knight Harkabada,